The Queen's Jewish Link presents the Jewish Living Podcast, the show that examines the many facets of Orthodox Jewish life. Here's your host, Izzo Zwirin.
Perhaps one of the positive things that came out of COVID was highlighting the gaps in certain aspects of life. Once we were plunged into an uncertain amount of time where we would be connecting with others almost exclusively via virtual methods, we became aware of just how lacking we were in the needs of those who are not regularly in social settings. However, our guest today had this issue on his radar long before COVID was on any of ours.
My name is Rabbi Johnny Solomon. I'm originally from the UK. I've now lived in Israel for the past 10 years. I teach a midrash at Lindenbaum in Matan. I edit Jewish books, and I'm what I call the virtual rabbi. I'm a rabbi to those without a rabbi, and I offer online spiritual coaching, halachic consultations, and one-to-one learning to men, women, and couples around the world.
Rabbi Solomon will tell us about his role as the virtual rabbi, what kinds of shilas he may be dealing with, and what he thinks the future of virtual rabbonus looks like. Rabbi Solomon, thank you so much for actually rejoining me this time. You're one of our repeat guests. The last time you were on, I had you on with two of your colleagues.
That's right. I do a podcast called Arzi Weekly with Rabbi Reuven Spolter and Rabbi Marty Brofsky, who are great. But this time I'm flying solo.
That's right. And of course, we're going to link to the Arzi Daily. Was it again? Sorry?
Arzi Weekly.
That's right.
Although we don't always do it every week, but we endeavor.
Same thing here. So we're going to link to that in our show notes. But this time we invited Rabbi Solomon back on here to discuss. I don't think it's a new program, but it's definitely taken on a different life over the last couple of years. Virtual rabbi. So first of all, give us a little bit of a background on you as a person. And then if you can give us a little bit of an intro to what the virtual rabbi is.
Okay, great. So thank you so much, Isa, for having me. I'm a person, I'm a Jew. I'm a Jew who grew my religious practice as a teenager. I'm Sephardi, although I grew up in Ashkenazi community. I'm religious, although I have a lot of not religious family members in the UK and in Israel. I mention that because I understand people who perhaps don't fit in boxes, or people with complicated families. And I was lucky to grow up in a community with an outstanding Rav Posek, Dayan Gershon Lopian, a Talmud Mupak of Moshe Feinstein, the grandson of Avelia Lopian. And I learned a lot from him in terms of how to be a Rav and how to Paskin and how to engage with lots of different people. It's quite unique to have such an extraordinary Posek for a very, very traditional community. I learned in Yeshiva and I came back to the UK, and I've basically been teaching in high schools for quite some years, until I decided to train to learn for smicha in the UK in something called the Montefiore Kollel. And there I took some time out to learn under the head of the Sephardi Bet Din, Dayan Sadia Amor. One of the teachers was Rabbi Sachs. In fact, he's one of the signatories on my smicha. And basically at that point, I was considering to continue in chinuch or to go into rabbonus. Unfortunately, my wife became sick because of meningitis. I returned back to the classroom. But there came a point in time, for various hashkafic reasons, personal reasons, that I said, you know, I want to fulfill my dream of making Aliyah. And my wife, myself, and our five daughters moved to Israel in 2012, 10 years ago. But I've always been very, very passionate about teaching, very, very passionate about halacha. And I've been inspired by my Rav to try and be an open-minded, helpful individual who tries to guide people who reach out to me. And when I made Aliyah, I decided to share more Torah using the medium called social media. I was living originally in Yad Binyamin. I now live in a place called Eben Shmuel. And through social media, basically, I've developed a network of people who seem to like the ideas that I share. In fact, already for 2.5 years, I've been writing a daily thought on Daf Yomi. So I basically have developed, shall we say, a followership, although I certainly don't get too excited by the amount of likes and the amount of followers and the amount of friends, you know, that some people get excited by. But with that opportunity to teach and that platform comes also responsibility, both in terms of the people I've been teaching in classrooms here in Israel. I teach in seminaries. I've taught in Machon Mayan. I currently teach in Midrash at Lindenbaum. I teach in Matan. So people have turned to me for guidance through those places, but also through the online platform called Facebook and other things. People ask shilas. People have sought guidance. And through the interactions I've had in person, online, I've realized that a lot of people are searching, a lot of people are in need of guidance. A lot of people don't have a rabbi, or even if they do, they don't feel they can talk to them. And that makes me sad, because I was blessed to have basically the full package. But many people don't have that. And yet their same issues arise as they did in my life. Sometimes their issues are even more complicated. And basically, with the responsibility, what it means to be a Rav, you know, Moshe Feinstein writes in the Hakdama Igros Moshe, we have a responsibility once you learn in order to share. And if you have been basically recognized as somebody who is qualified to pass, and one should do so. With that responsibility meant that when people turned to me for guidance, I felt a responsibility to respond, obviously, responsibly. And over time, people would call me, they'd speak to me, and I created this flat platform called the Virtual Rabbi, a rabbi for those without a rabbi. I'm somebody who very much respects the importance of somebody having a connection with the community Rav. But I see in America, a lot of people don't have rabbanim or don't feel they connect to them. A lot of people in Israel don't have a rabbanim, don't feel they connect to them. Here in Israel, only 25% of shuls have a full-time Rav. And so a lot of people are falling through the gaps, and it's having an impact on the life choices they make. We see rising assimilation in the States, in Europe, even here in Israel too. And basically, I'm trying to do my bit to be some kind of Manig Yisrael, if you call that kind of term, be a teacher, be a guide, try and be there for those who want to talk to me. And so my rabbonus isn't based on the shul that people go to. It's not based on any sense of authority. I don't force my opinion on anybody. Whoever calls me, whoever wants to talk to me, I'm there for them. And I've created a framework which I think works for the modern man or woman or couple, whereby I'm not doing them a favor. Instead, they're able to book a session with me, pay me for that time, but in so doing, get a service. And they appreciate the fact that just like you go and get a service from any other professional, they are being given guidance which has been thoughtful, which has been prepared, and hopefully which responds to their issues, to the questions they have in their life.
So that sounds like a fantastic model. It's something that's new and fresh. First of all, when did you actually start this, and how has it progressed over the course of time?
So informally, a lot of people have been reaching out to me maybe for the last 6-7 years. And obviously, as a teacher, for probably 20 or so years, I've had students ask me questions, friends ask me questions. In my neighborhood, people would say, hey, Johnny, what do you think of this? So informally, for many, many years, people have sought my advice in one way or another. But in terms of me formalizing this framework and creating a platform on my website, and such that people can book in a session and using technologies such as Calendly, that's now about, I think, about towards 2.5-3 years old. And what I've tried to do is make it a frictionless encounter, meaning if nowadays, if somebody wants to speak to Rav, they message them, the Rav may not be available, and then you have to find a time when they're available, and then you feel that they're doing you a favor, and then you try and cut the conversation short. And in the end, you may have asked one of the 15 questions you want to ask, but most real Shiders deserve conversations. And most people who don't have a relationship with the Rav they're asking are never going to get the right psak, because that Rav doesn't know who they are, what their context is, right? And it's essential to realize that real shailas come from real shailim, and to give a good response, whatever it could be a hashkafic question or a halachic question, you need to know, who am I talking to? So if you've known that person for many years, then you don't need all of that preparation, because you've known them, you understand where they're coming from, you may know their family, where they live. But if you don't know them, you need that time. So creating a framework where people can tell me a little bit about them ahead of our online meeting, that I prepare based on what they've told me ahead of our online meeting. We have an hour online meeting where we discuss the questions they want to discuss, and oftentimes reveal that there are many, many more issues to hand, and have some follow-up. That whole platform is, say, 2.5-3 years old, and it's growing. It's growing because obviously I'm endeavoring to grow it. But it's also grown because people want this. There is a need, there's a tzairach, and people want to feel that they're a mensch, that when they get religious advice, that they're being treated, not necessarily as a customer, that's not how I look at people, I sometimes use the word client, but they don't want to feel that something often very, very important to their life is being squeezed in between things. The questions people have to ask are things deserving of real time, and I try and make sure that I give people real time.
So I was funny. I was going to ask you what you call the people that reach out to you. Are they your clients? Are they, what are they? but more importantly, who like without obviously giving me any personal information, like who are the clients? What are the types of people that are reaching out to you?
Okay, so I use the word clients, although it's a slightly imperfect term, because obviously I want to understand who these people are in order to give them, you know, halachic or hashkafic guidance, which is right according to their needs and their situation. I also want to be very clear that unlike my relationship with my Rav, who basically was prepared to tell me what to do and I was prepared for him to do so, that's not the dynamic of how I operate. Instead, people call me autonomously or book sessions, and I see myself more as a coach. And that's an interesting shift that a number of Jewish thinkers have noted in recent years. Yuval Sherlow has an interesting essay about psika in the postmodern world. So I see myself more as somebody who is an educator who lays out different approaches. And when we're dealing with halacha, I provide what I call a halachic consultation. I let people know what different options are, and then perhaps suggest that this would be more halakhically preferable, but also perhaps note that in their situation, this may well be a better outcome. Who are the people that answer genuinely anybody? The people who read what I read on a daily basis are men, women, and couples who are less observant and more observant. And I can tell you I have clients in L.A., in the Midwest, in New York. I have clients in Europe. I have clients in Israel. I have questions from people in South Africa, from Australia, from people who are not from at all, people who want to grow, people who are very from and have certain issues that they want to discuss, people who have really complicated childhoods, but they don't want to discuss it with their local Rav for whatever reason. They certainly need to talk it through with somebody. So there's no, you know, particular person. I can throw out some names of cities without in any way giving things away. You know, I can have a couple who live in the kind of the Gush area where one of the couple is from and the other one actually isn't, although they're kind of keeping up appearances and they want to know how do we handle this, right? I there can be somebody who lives in the States who really wants to grow religiously, but it's a little bit complicated in terms of their family. It can be a Rav who's got a crisis of faith and they want to talk things through with somebody. It can be somebody with a really complicated halachic question relating to their family or their child, and they want some advice. And so what I do, it's not just offering my opinion. I don't speak for my authority. I speak for the Torah that I've learned, I've received. And so I say I prepare material and I learn through material with clients. So if somebody says, I want to discuss this particular point with you, and this is my context, I think things through, I look through Sforim, I prepare Daf Makorot specific to them and in our session, then I say, based on what you said you want to discuss, let's learn through this Truv of the Sridei Eish. I'll explain it. I say, can you see what he's trying to say is this? Can you see how this relates to your situation? And then we can talk through what necessarily to do based on whatever issue has necessarily arisen. So really, I suppose I'm a shadchan of ideas with people, obviously, as well as in terms of the realm of psika, trying to listen very closely to where people are coming from and make some meaningful suggestions which are relevant and, you know, resonant to them.
So one of the things I was going to ask you, maybe it doesn't sound like you're doing this, but it might be something that it could expand to. You're not trying to really build some sort of an online kahila, an online community. It's not like you give like a shir and all of the people that you have seen are invited. Hey, anybody who wants to join, it's not like the people who see you know who each other are. So you're not building some
correct
sort of.
Bichlalo, on an Erev Shabbos, I send an Erev Shabbos message to my clients, but it's like a broadcast. It's nobody knows who's on that list. Right. And the truth is, yeah, confidentiality is crucially important. Most people are, you know, there's nothing in any way improper about wanting to seek particular guidance, but sometimes the issues people want to discuss are very delicate, very, very personal. And say, if they don't have a Rav, they turn to me, but sometimes they do. They still have decided for whatever their, you know, considerations, they want to discuss this with somebody they're not going to see this Shabbos at the Kiddush. And that's their right. Obviously, I encourage wherever possible that people should speak to the local Orthodox guide, etc. But where there's a particular situation where I know that that's not going to happen, we have a conversation. I share what I know. I don't tell the people what to do. As I say, it's really their choice to talk to me. But the difference is it's basically not to be what people call Rabbi Google. And, you know, I love technology, but where people look, I'm not trying to provide information. And Psak isn't information. Basically, you know, the realm of Psak is understanding text and context. So obviously we need to come with an understanding of our Masorah, of Mishnah, Gemara, of the Rishonim, Acharonim, etc. We also need to understand context, people's delicate situation. And sometimes there may well be factors which shift, obviously, what a book would say to be the right answer to, in their situation, being a very different answer.
So on the other side of it, have you gotten feedback from other Rabbanim, what they think of this? Do they think that you're maybe kind of encroaching on their territory, or are they supportive? How do reactions from other Rabbanim come to you?
So I say that I'm a disruptor, but in a sense that I want other Rabbanim to follow this model. I actually believe that the way I've made myself accessible is something that I'd love other Rabbanim to do. So this model isn't, you know, only Johnny's doing this. I'd like to think that other Rabbanim also try and create this kind of transparent, accessible, frictionless way in which they can be in contact with their congregants. I don't see myself in the slightest as being in the word competition, you know, with anybody else. Many of my friends, good friends, are Rabbanim. They work incredibly hard. On the contrary, I actually feel that many modern Rabbanim are under such pressure to put on, for example, big events, and they're oftentimes under such pressure to adapt to challenges of things like COVID, that the important but not urgent issues, the kind of ones that come my way, get dropped. So, I mean, I'm not at the moment, you know, I'm not burying people. And for the most part, I'm not marrying people or going to Bris Milah. The issue that people are asking me are generally important but non-urgent. And I do believe that for a whole bunch of factors, modern Rabbanim sometimes don't have the capacity to do that. And by the way, they'd be the first to say it's really frustrating that we don't have the capacity to do that. So any feedback I've had by, you know, my friends, by rabbinical colleagues in different situations is, wow, that's very, very interesting. I think people are curious. People are watching this model that I'm doing. Obviously, it's different to being paid by a community and then being owned by that community. And there are pros and there are cons. But even if people say, what does he know and why is he answering things? The fact is I write a lot of Torah ideas, which a lot of people seem to like. So I'm very clear about who I am, and I'm very transparent about what I'm trying to achieve. And I have no, you know, goals of trying to create any kind of online community. As I say, the clients don't know one another. And if somebody has a rav, I say the first thing I'd say is talk to them, because the whole reason why I'm doing what I'm doing is coming from a place of, I was blessed to have that kind of relationship with the Rav, but I see that many people don't. And they're therefore living lives which are lacking the voice of Torah when it comes down to big decision-making. So the general kind of response would be, somebody else is working alongside us to help Jews in our neighborhood or beyond our neighborhood, trying to live lives which are more cognizant of Torah law, Torah values. And so everything I've received is very, very positive. And if other people, have semblance of suspicion, there's everything I'm doing is right on the table and very, very clear. Everything is very clear also on my website about also who I am. I think if one were to be acting otherwise, that'd be another thing. There is one further thing I do want to say, which is I personally find it quite uncomfortable to put myself out there. I'm much more of an introvert, and also beyond this, I was lucky to have, serious Talmidei Chachamim as Rabbanim, and I was lucky to receive brachos from Mamash Gedolim, Rav Avadya, Rav Eliyashiv. So I'm not naive in terms of how I see myself vis-a-vis the authors of the Sfarim that line my study, and you can see where I'm sitting right now. Nevertheless, there is a further factor which prompts me to push myself out there, which is, living in a time where there is a marketplace of ideas in basically not just social media, in the internet age. And there are a lot of charlatans. There are a lot of people who basically say whatever they say, who don't come from a place of Masorah. Don't come from a place of knowledge of Torah. Oftentimes, who are very flippant about Torah values, and that's even within Orthodoxy, let alone beyond it. And I feel a duty to be a voice to of opposition, basically, to those who I think misrepresent Torah. So if I make a mistake, my rabbinical friends know that they can call me and they say, Johnny, we don't like how you said this, and they know we'll have a great conversation, and I'll be made if I think they're right, and if not, I'll tell them what I think. But part of our duty in a world right now where there's a battlefield ideas is to be present. And until COVID, truth be told, there weren't very many Orthodox Rabbonim talking seriously about Torah, talking seriously about Halacha on social media. There was me and a few, you know, some other people. Obviously, there are others who are working in the field of Kiruv, which is wonderful. During COVID, that number increased a little bit. But so I'm not just going putting myself out there because I'm trying to grow this thing called the Virtual Rabbi. I also am doing this. And for example, my Daf Yomi has got nothing to do with this. I'm also putting myself out there because we need to put out, you know, thoughtful, Masorah rooted Torah ideas that can be read, appreciated, and understood by any Jew from whatever background. And if Orthodox Jews aren't doing it, trust me, non-Orthodox Jews are doing it, and many others who want to misrepresent the Torah. So I also see myself as being a warrior trying to battle an ideology taking place, which unfortunately I think there are too few people necessarily rolling their sleeves up to do that in the kind of way that I'm doing so. Basically, I'm trying to speak up for, you know, thoughtful Torah to Judaism.
So there's a lot that you said there that I want to react to, but you did say the magic word, and that's COVID. So we have to go down that route. Now you said this, you started this more in a formal sense 2.5-3 years ago. So I'm guessing more or less a couple of months before COVID started.
Yeah, I was developing already, and I kind of like, I used the time to make it a little bit better when I was stuck at home a little bit more.
So I'm not going to ask you how COVID impacted the rise of the virtual rabbi. I'm sure there was probably some correlation there, but I'm more interested in how you see COVID affecting now that we're kind of hopefully on the other side of COVID, we're on the downslope. I know there's still some times that you have a rise in cases and different variants coming around. For the most part, we're basically past where we were a year ago. And I want to see if that has any lasting effects. Do you see that now that we're kind of past that and maybe people are going out more, maybe people are back to the shuls that they were in, that they're maybe contacting you less? Or is this something that kind of stayed with you and stayed with us as a nation and as a world after COVID, that people are looking more on in the online community to find someone that can do what maybe someone would have had to do in person before COVID started?
Okay, so you asked two questions. I'll answer. The work that I'm doing as a virtual rabbi preceded COVID. It was just buoyed, shall we say, by that. People want deep, meaningful conversations, and they appreciate it from the comfort of their home. And so COVID, all that did was give us a better understanding of how that was possible. Meaning I was using Zoom already for many years, way before COVID. Many other people, that word Zoom became basically, you know, a byword for the COVID era. So all that COVID did was make people more comfortable with platforms that I was already using. In terms of me myself, I don't meet clients face-to-face other than one individual who is a gentleman who is disabled, and I make an exception to him because I meet men, women, and couples. I have a simple clout. I only meet people online. I meet people at different times around the world. So even if all the COVID restrictions were to change, I'm still going to default to choosing to meet people through a screen because I think it helps protect a certain sense of boundaries and appropriate boundaries. And that's something which is very, very important to me. In terms of your question about COVID and how people are feeling, well, there's a lot of endeavor for Rabbonim in Canada, in America, in the UK to try and get people back to shul. And some people are and some people aren't. And different people are trying to do what they can to nudge people in that direction. There are important lessons that people have learned from COVID that some people, now that they've become used to a Kabbalah Shabbos at home, which is oftentimes they used to even do musical Kabbalah Shabboses in different places and stop at Mizmor Shir. So how are you going to now respond if you get people back to shul? So an Orthodox shul, which thought so much out the box during COVID, needs to kind of ask themselves, can we really bring things back exactly as things were now? And I would say, no, you shouldn't. It wouldn't be wise. You need to try and find a sweet spot, which is sufficiently engaging for people who are actually uplifted and inspired by the kind of programming that was done, given the limitations of COVID. So there are obviously great tragedies that happened during COVID. I was recently back in the UK, and the large Jewish cemetery in Bushey is now full. They've now opened another part. But a lot of that is burials because of COVID, meaning there's a sad reality that a lot of people died. But apart from that terrible loss of lives, shuls and community centers should try and harness what they've learned from this difficult period of time. Think about some of the creative ways in which we responded to the needs of people. Recognize that some should remain basically in emergency need only, but others perhaps can be incorporated up to some level to try and make tefillah and community activities more accessible. So even right now, I teach in Matan, we are still having classes where some people are coming in person and some people are learning online. As a teacher, it's less good for me. Meaning 3 years ago, everyone came in person. That was it. Because of COVID, then everything was online. Now we try to return to some kind of amicable arrangement where some people still want to stay at home and some people are coming in person. How do I nudge my students to come in person? Well, I've got a plan for the coming year to try and make our share to be much more interactive, and there'll be some chavrusas. But for the individual who it was a schlep to come, this gift of learning from home is not something you necessarily want to so quickly, you know, snatch away from them. And it takes chokhmah, it takes wisdom to know what to keep and what to remove. And each person should consider what their context, what their situation demands, and what their people really are interested in.
Now, the other thing you mentioned before was, you briefly mentioned it, a simcha, like you a burial, something like that, that you kind of have to be there for. But I wanted to talk to you about other limitations that the virtual rabbi has. I was thinking things along the lines of, you're not answering Nida Shilas, you're not answering anything that happens on Shabbos or Yontif that needs to be answered right away. And because you're a scheduled model, you're not answering emergency situations that need to be happening like right now. I need to find that out. Do you have something in mind for these types of things, or am I missing something else that you're limited to?
So in terms of Nida, I don't pass in Nida Shilas, just in general. The reason I don't do that is not because I haven't learned, but because my Rav was such a mumcha, and I had shimush from him up to a point, but I said unless I'd had full shimush from him, I don't paskin. I know what a posek for Nidda should do, and I don't see that happening from most other people. And I'm, because of my fear of passing the chumrah, I don't. And Baruch Hashem, there are lots of other networks, you know, things like Yotzot Halacha, and I very much are happy to recommend that people turn to those and people local to my community. That's Davar Echad. The Varsheni, you know, weddings. I'm actually, I do weddings. Well, I'm soon to be doing weddings here in Israel under Tsar. But in terms of, you know, Shabbos Shalis, you're right, of course. But even if somebody has a Rav, it's not always the one who is within one block of where they live. So obviously that question would apply with that individual themselves. If a question is likely to arise and a person wants to discuss it with me, that's more than fine. The whole, as mentioned, I'm not actually somebody's Rav that I'm putting my authority in on what they do. If they want to talk to me about a particular thing, then I make myself available to them. However, you talked about emergencies. The answers I do get, and actually, because of the way I'm trying to respond to the needs of people quite literally around the world, I wake up to Shilas, you know, and go to sleep talking to people. On a number of occasions in recent months, people have called me minutes before Shabbos, next to a dying parent. What do I say? What do we do? And I made myself available, obviously. So I'm not trying to, as I say, trying to replace a community Rav. That's not my function, bichlal. I say, if you have that, you are so lucky. But I know that As I say, here in Israel, 50% of shuls don't have rabbis. 25 have part-time rabbis, and only 25 have full-time. I know that there are people in communities where they just don't have a go-to person. And if it is a go-to person, perhaps they don't feel they can resonate with them. So for that person, whomever that is, that man, that woman, that couple, if they feel that I'm right for them, I'm available to them. If they don't feel I'm right for them, that's totally their right. But they shouldn't feel that they have an issue, they have a question, and nobody's there for them. They shouldn't feel they have to default to Googling it, because that's absurd. And then we're living in a time where people are actually, you know, self-paskening from what you can find in an internet search engine, which, if anybody knows anything about halacha, that's it's both an absurdity and likely to lead people to make mistakes, oftentimes make their lives more difficult than necessarily need be. So, you know, the virtual rabbi has its limitations, of course it is, but that's, I'm trying to fill that gap for those who don't have the blessing of what I hope many people do have, which is a go-to, you know, male or female religious guide to whom they can speak to from the heart about things that matter, to whom they can feel comfortable to share the real issues that go in their life, and feel that that individual is qualified to give them advice rather than just offer what they think.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of the different things that people call and talk to you about, or Zoom and talk to you about. Can you go through some of those areas? I from what I've picked up so far, you had a little bit of halacha shailas, a little bit of hashkafa guidance. There's some Torah study, if you want to have, I guess, a chavrusa with you, or shiurim. Is there anything that you want to expand on any of those things, or is there anything that I'm missing?
So the truth is, most sessions are a little bit of all three. If somebody wants to have a halachic consultation, it really means they often need coaching in terms of how to deal with a particular situation. And if they want spiritual coaching, oftentimes involves some kind of halachic issue that may well be arising in their life, if not now, but very, very soon. If they want to learn with me, there's because they want to schmooze about some other thing. They, you know, most people don't say, I just want to learn an Aruch HaShul. I said, fine, that's beautiful, but the fact that they're calling me to do that means that they have an interest in having conversations, you know, in between the words or in between the lines of what they're learning, as oftentimes most successful chavrusas do. So every case is unique. Every person is different. And that's the whole point. In fact, just to give you a brief story, I've probably shared this story once or twice online, but when my Rav was Nifta and I was speaking to a dear friend who was going to give a hesped, I said, remember to tell the crowd that he never answered shilas. And my friend said, what are you talking about? He answered thousands of shilas. I said, no, he answered shilim. He answered questions. And every question is different. And because every question is different, the situation of somebody who is religiously growing, who has a complicated family issue, where there is coaching skills that come into play, you know, paskening issues that very much are part of parts of our conversation, and wisdom and knowledge that needs to be shared as part of that's what any Rav or Rebbetzin should be doing, obviously. But I recently was talking to somebody who is dealing with an issue of intermarriage in their family, and that was both a question of personal coaching, how they cope with this, but they were asking shilas about what to do with this. And obviously we went through certain sugyas and we talked through certain approaches, and that too, through learning, helped that person feel that this isn't just, you know, one person's opinion, but this is a normative approach in terms of how to deal with this issue that's going on in their life and actually in the lives of more people.
I'm very interested in hearing what you think the future of this type of a model looks like. So you said that you're not looking to monopolize this. You're not going to be the only virtual rabbi. Maybe you're the only one with a title of the virtual rabbi, because you kind of made that your own. But if somebody were to pick up this ball and run with it, what do you think you could see growing out of this type of a model, or maybe even going a different model that somebody uses you as a platform to base theirs off of?
There are lots and lots of people who are now available, who are personalities to whom people turn to for guidance, for leadership, for inspiration. Many of them are people I know, I respect, I admire, and that's wonderful. Very few people have done what I do, which is actually going back to basics, meaning I'm actually a very simple person. I want people to have the bread and butter of Judaism. Have somebody there for you who's going to basically be a voice to you of Torah when you most need it, and who can speak to you directly and sometimes tell you things that you don't want to hear. And see, this is something which is really important. There is such a desire to please people that sometimes those who are influential religious voices say what others want to hear. People may well book a session with me, but part of the spiritual coaching process is about asking hard questions, asking people to look at things very, very differently, and sometimes accept or acknowledge things that perhaps nobody else has said to them as directly as I've done. So these are not always easy conversations. In fact, I won't give you details because it's too personal, but there was a really difficult Shiloh that came my way a few months ago that was incredibly tough, and I had to tell a couple things they knew they needed to hear, but I had to be the first one to tell it to them. We had to go through a certain process. But they trusted that I was the right person to do so, and I've been obviously in subsequent contact. How do I see other people doing this? I don't know. Many people, when you're in, let's say, a yeshiva seminary environment, there is this kind of dynamic between the Rebbe and the student, and you are being some kind of, you're not virtual, obviously, you're in person, and you have those deep and meaningful conversations when they touch on hashkafa and halacha and learning. But then people leave yeshiva and seminary. And then what happens is those kind of deep and meaningful conversations become much, much more sparse. You know, if you're a man, or especially if you're a woman, you may be able to say hello to the rabbi in a kiddush, but the issue you're having about faith, you know, when are you going to have a chance to have that conversation? Especially if it's to say it's a non-urgent conversation. But those things still weigh on the shoulders of people. They sometimes can cause them to, you know, get very, very anxious, sometimes even depressed. So what I'm trying to do is continue that model for those in need. And I think there are a lot of people in need. If other people adapt this, I say, you know, what does they say? Imitation is the greatest form of flattery. If somebody says, Johnny, this is a great idea, I want to borrow it, you know, I say, wonderful. But where we are right now is the following. And this is crucial to see the global world. I speak not just as a yachid, but as somebody who's sensitive to the situation of klal. We're living in a time right now when we're in North America, outside of Orthodoxy, about 76-78% of Jews are assimilating. Okay, that's bad, objectively. We're living in a time where in Israel, actually, secular Jews getting married under chuppah of kiddushin is taking a bit of a sell. It's not so simple. It's not poshut. It's not as it was. That's the work of people like Tzara trying to do that. But there is even forms of assimilation happening in Israel, not just assimilation in terms of intermarriage, but assimilation in terms of ebbing away and stepping away from even the most traditional of practices. In terms of the wider Jewish world, there are people who don't even want to identify as Jews. And where people do have questions and do have issues, we're living in a time where, unfortunately, the voices of some rabbonim are very judgmental. What people hear about religion on the news is often very, very critical. And you get one chance to get it right. Otherwise, somebody's going to feel alienated. So it's not me. Every one of us can have hashpa on the world. Every single one of us, through our interactions with another person, can either be the maker or breaker of their choice to continue to explore their religious practice. And everybody often is carrying challenges in their own life, and they want to be understood and they want to be heard. And they often don't feel they have a mane, they don't have a person that they can talk to. And even the most observant of people, I assure you, this isn't just for the less observant, even the most observant, often they feel, who am I going to talk to about this thing, about this question about emunah, about these doubts I have about myself, about whether what I'm doing right on Hilchos Shabbos is, you know, there was a beautiful couple, a frum couple, about a year ago, they contacted me. They said, we keep Shabbos, but we sometimes have questions. We're not quite sure we're getting things right. Can we just do a brief refresher course on Hilchos Shabbos? I said, I love you. You're amazing. We just had like 2-3 sessions. They gave me a set of areas where they said, we just want to review certain issues to do with, you know, Shabbos in the kitchen. Basically, they were doing everything right, but they just wanted that reassurance. These things are valuable. These things are important. So we need to make sure that we're out there for people. And the marketplace is basically, you know, the internet, as well as obviously the physical marketplace. But if a Rav is going to wait in their shul for Rav Am Yisrael to walk through the door, they're not coming. They're not coming to shul. They're not coming to Jewish schools. They're not even nowadays coming, the Tzareinu Rav, to Kol Nidre. You've got to make yourself available. You've got to be a voice, and you've got to sometimes use modern language. So I call it spiritual coaching. What, you know, that's just a modern way of saying, I'm there to give some kind of chizuk to people who are in need of it. But I use a general word, spiritual coaching, because if I'd say chizuk, then a whole bunch of the audience wouldn't understand it. But I'd love more and more people who, obviously, only those who know what they're talking about, because people who misrepresent things aren't doing anybody any favors. But those who have been blessed to learn, and those who have responsibility, therefore, to teach, need to make sure that they're doing what they can to be there for Am Yisrael. I'm doing my bit. If I could do it better, you know, I'm happy to receive feedback. But there are people who aren't coming to shul, but they are hungry for learning. There are people who aren't going to Rabbanim, but they still have shilas. So where are they going? If they went to Aish, that was great, but now they're not 18, they're 28, right? If they went to some kind of kirov organization, but now they've gotten old and they've got family and live somewhere else, and they don't know who to turn to. So I'm just trying to be there for them. And if we say, how about Chabad? I say Chabad does amazing work, but you can't expect everything to fall on the shoulders of Chabad. And by the way, I believe that we're all shlichim. So, you know, who's to say that I don't also have a responsibility to be there for Am Yisrael? So I'm doing my bit. It's something which is something I'm very, very passionate about. It's something I did for many, many years, and not through this kind of paid framework. I don't think I charge so much for it to be a problematic price point. And I also see people, whatever their circumstance. But this is what I'm doing, but it's something I'm very, very welcome for other people to do as well.
All right, so just because you mentioned the pricing, you have it's basically a fee for service model. You don't have like everything these days is like a subscription based service.
There's no subscription.
No subscription. I can't be like, all right, I want a weekly chavrusa with Rabbi Solomon. I want to do this once a week for the next 52 weeks.
If somebody wanted that, fine, but then I'd reduce the price and we do it. But no, in general, people meet me, you know, a few times. And the more we see each other, the more I want to make it as reasonable for somebody. As I say, if people aren't able to do that, I never turn anybody away. And I also never pressure a person after a session to meet me again. You know, so imagine you go to a massage and they say, I think you should come again. I don't do that because it's important. And by the way, a lot of people would say, you should. That's how you should run a business. I say, yeah, but I'm not really running. This is a calling in which I'm somewhat being mafanes, my family, but I'm coming to this from a place of pina chrayas for Am Yisrael. So yeah, my time takes, you know, my time is time, and therefore I charge a little bit for my time, but I don't put pressure on people to meet me. If somebody wants to, fun, wonderful, but it has to be that they're meeting with me because they want to. They have to be ready, and that's, by the way, a klal not just in halacha, but it's also a klal in coaching, right? A person who wants to be coached needs to say, "I'm ready, hineni." And so, when somebody books, they're saying, "I'm ready." When somebody goes on my site and puts in that information, they're saying, "Let's talk," and I'm saying, "Let's do that." Fantastic. But the model is very much on the part of the client, for them to want it, for them to recognize their needs. I'm not there to force them to say, but you need to meet me. That's not who I am. There's no emotional manipulation at all. Instead, if somebody wants to talk about something that matters in their life and they feel that I'm the right person to do so, and they look on my website and they can read about me and they can make their own evaluations. And there are testimonials by, you know, clients, and they say this is the right guy and they book, then we meet.
So that brings up the last piece of this. What is your website? Where can people find you? Are you on social media? And where can people see some more of your work?
So my website is rabbijohnnysolomon.com. I write quite a lot on Facebook. I mentioned Dafyomi, which you can also find on my website. My work, I write in different places as well. And I teach in different places as well. And I'm fairly, and say to my mind, the internet is a place where we're going to find the Jews who aren't coming to the shuls, the Jews who aren't going to the Jewish school. So I make myself pretty present, pretty visible, so that people can find me and people like me. And I very much like shouting out, men and women who I think are very skilled, who has skill sets which complement mine or different to mine for that matter. But that's where I can be found, rabbijohnnysolomon.com or Facebook. You can find me there. Instagram, I'm on there. I'm not on Twitter because I think that's annoying. I'm definitely not on TikTok because I think that's inappropriate. But I also do a podcast and write here or there.
And one more time, where can people find the podcast, RZ Weekly?
The podcast, RZ Weekly. You can, if you look on Spotify and the Apple Store.
Apple Store, yeah.
Basically, on all good
Apple Store, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud.
Right, sure. Google Play. All the good stuff. That's all, you know, with great thanks to our technician, who's also my co-host, Rabbi Reuven Spalter, who works very, very hard to get all that back end stuff done. And in those podcasts, we talk through issues to do with religious Zionism, modern Orthodoxy, and everything in between. And I suppose just to make reference to that term modern Orthodox, I mentioned beforehand that I grew my religious practice. I'm generally identified as being somebody from the religious Zionist modern Orthodox world, which is true. I live in a kind of more religious Zionist yeshuv. That's kind of the world that I belong to. But I've been lucky to learn Torah from the great. I don't draw these distinctions. Torah is Torah, and that I certainly learn and love. And I think what people appreciate in terms of me is I'm cognizant of and non-judgmental about the kind of choices sometimes people have to make in terms of living in the modern world. So as I say, I harness technology. I recognize the kind of lives that people are living. And that too is part of parcel of the attraction of this thing called virtual rabbi, because people say, oh, he gets me. He understands what a 25, 30 year old man or woman is likely to be doing and living. And I'm able to have a conversation without feeling that the individual's looking down at me. Not that all rabbanim do that, but sometimes there's a feeling that some people do. So part and parcel of those taglines and identities, I think, seem to interest some of my clients, or at least make them feel that I'm a useful voice that aligns with some of their values, some of their worldview.
All right, Rabbi Solomon, thank you so much for joining me this week. It is now approaching 5 o'clock my time, which means that it's approaching 12 o'clock your time.
It is literally near the pumpkin time.
Yeah.
Yofi, thank you so much. Good to see you.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Solomon. My thanks to Rabbi Johnny Solomon for joining me this week. I'm always interested in hearing how people are using advancements in technology to enhance the Jewish experience. Obvious examples are from social media presences and podcasts such as this one. It's even better when someone is doing something unique for the Frum population. If you're interested in learning about another such person and about other ways in which technology is affecting halacha and vice versa, check out episode 55, Technology and Halacha, with Dr. Liz Shane. Until next time, Kol Tov.
The Jewish Living Podcast is produced by Sreli Pikus. Our theme song is The Band by A.B. Rottenberg. Follow us on Facebook at The Jewish Living Podcast and on Twitter and Instagram at Jewish_living. You can also email the show at jewishlivingpodcast@gmail.com. The Jewish Living Podcast is recorded in conjunction with the Queens Jewish Link.